This is the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've got a busy Friday show for you. Let's start in Springfield. For nearly a year, colleges and universities in Illinois have limped along with no money from the state. Finally, late last night, there were signs of a compromise. Republicans and Democrats in Springfield were set to approve hundreds of millions of dollars in funding. Governor Bruce Rauner sounded supportive of the proposal that would keep schools like Chicago State and Eastern Illinois afloat through the summer while adding some stability to other state campuses. Then, late last night, after a rare display of discord among Democratic lawmakers, it was pulled without even going to a vote. Well, the State House and Senate are back today, and so is the finger pointing. We're up against a May 1st deadline for Chicago State, saying that it can't pay salaries after that point. Eastern and Western Illinois universities are making cuts and layoffs. Even the University of Illinois said this week it's preparing for layoffs. So what went wrong yesterday at the Capitol and what's next? Let's start with Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey. He covers state politics and government and joins us from member station WUIS in Springfield. Hey, Brian.
Hello. How are you?
Good. So just about half an hour or so, I saw we got some movement from the Illinois House. What happened? Did this bill finally did pass?
Yeah, so this is a slightly, it was taken out last night because there were a few Democrats pushing to include some funding for human services, social services. These are the state vendors that take care of the disabled, elderly, people with mental health and substance abuse problems. They have not also, they have also been excluded from state funding as well as higher education. There were a few Democrats who wanted to see them added in, and so they put a hold on that legislation last night. But this morning, apparently there's going to be a separate, smaller move for social services. We can talk about that a little later, but the higher ed funding bill did pass the House, and even as we're talking, that legislation is now being called in the Senate. So it appears to be back on a fast track, and we can talk a little bit more later about what's in that.
Right. So let's go to the social services in a minute. Let's hold that one for the higher ed bill. It looks like this bill is going to be about, according to the House version, $600 million to universities and community colleges to keep them operating through the summer.
Yeah, that's right. So it breaks down about $356 million for universities, community colleges get about $75 million. There's also a significant amount of money, $170 million, not nearly full funding, but some money for MAP grants. These are the monetary award program. This helps people from low-income families be able to afford college. And those go not only to public universities, but also private universities in the state of Illinois.
Right. So lots of Illinois college students right now, really happy to hear that, I'm sure, Brian. And you said that this is moving pretty quickly through the Senate, because I know the Senate is supposed to adjourn fairly soon for the Passover holiday, right? But it looks, are you saying this looks like this may get through the Senate before they are gone for the week?
Yeah, as I understand, as we're talking, you know, we check Twitter a lot nowadays, and it appears to be up for debate at this very moment in the Senate. And the governor has indicated his support of this legislation. Even as things appeared to be hitting the rocks last night and potentially falling apart, he put out a an uncharacteristically measured statement where he did not attack people and said he applauds those that are working together and supports this effort to create this stopgap. Because as you said, Chicago State seems to be in an existential crisis. They've issued layoff notices to all 900 people that work there, from the president on down to the faculty and staff. And they said that they wouldn't be able to meet payroll after the end of the month.
Yeah.
So they compressed their semester and are holding graduation ceremonies next week.
And one of the things that wasn't clear to me about in terms of the social services, Brian, it sort of seems like there's clearly a sentiment among a lot of Democratic lawmakers that they, while everyone wants to have state universities funded, they want to make sure social services agencies don't get left behind in all of this, right?
That's right. And so you have every time you take pressure off the, you know, the budget impasse, as it's been called, if you remove a pressure point, that everybody breathes a little easier here in Springfield, and maybe the urgency dies down for a while to save these other programs that are out there. We've already had social service agencies that have shut their doors, laid off staff, or at least reduced accepting new people into them. So that system is really on the rocks. A number of these agencies, people say they're not going to come back now that they've collapsed. The professionals who work there have moved on to other states and other things. So that is something that has been a big priority for Democrats. And that's sort of a split. Do you keep fighting and try and get the Republicans to cry uncle and say, you know, we're just going to knuckle under or give on, you know, give in and allow you to pass a budget with a tax increase and cuts and none of the governor's demands, or do you try and get some of that? So it's been a contentious week, certainly.
So it looks like we may have a resolution on higher ed funding. We still are waiting then on all of these other social service agencies.
Yeah, as last I heard, and again, this is a very fluid situation.
Yeah, everything's moving really quickly.
Yeah, the last I heard is that the Senate would be taking up a second bill for human services today.
Okay, well, that's Brian Mackey with Illinois Public Radio, obviously covering a really fast-moving situation in the Capitol for us. Thanks for that. And of course, you can stay tuned to this and for the rest of the afternoon for all of the updates on what's going on in Springfield. Thanks, Brian.
Happy to be here.
You're listening to The 21st. We hear a lot about cybersecurity these days, from federal government databases being hacked to your own credit card information getting stolen. Cybersecurity hits all levels of life. That's the business for Marcin Kliczynski. He's founder and CEO of an anti-malware company. Malware Bytes was started in a dorm room in Urbana and officially founded in Chicago in 2008. Each year, its software cleans up hundreds of millions of computers worldwide. Last year, Marcin was named to the Forbes 30 Under 30 list for enterprise technology. He's back in Illinois tomorrow to speak at a sold-out TEDx conference on the U of I campus. So we asked him to come on the 21st Now so everyone can hear what he has to say. He's joining us by phone from California. Marcin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I understand that when you were a teenager, you got your parents' computer infected, and that led you to teaching yourself how to code. What's the story there?
Yeah, I loved downloading video games, and of course loved stealing video games at the time. We couldn't really afford the paid
okay.
versions from the store, so
right.
all of a sudden pop-ups are coming up, and who knows what's going on with the computer, and I had to try to disinfect that before the parents got too upset. And then I bought a Four Dummies book, one of those yellow ones that make you feel really embarrassed reading it in public. But learned everything I could from that and started programming software.
Did it say malware for dummies or did it say coding for dummies?
No, it was coding for dummies, specifically Visual Basic, but it doesn't matter what it said, right? It's still pretty embarrassing to read one of those books.
Well, embarrassing, but how old were you at the time?
So I was, I think, 17 when we first released the product, and then I went to the University of Illinois just shortly thereafter and to learn how to really program.
Okay, so not so embarrassing for you. I was going to say as a 17-year-old.
Yeah, exactly.
And as you said, you were a student at the U of I when you started the company. You ran this company out of your dorm room for some time. What was that like?
Really interesting. You know, running the company out of the dorm room, especially my freshman year and then sophomore year, there was never a dull moment. Hooligans running through the hall sometimes as I'm on a press call or with customers was certainly an eye-opening experience. And then trying to balance the time of going to classes, you know, luckily I had I was in computer science and a lot of the lectures were online. It was really advanced time that I went to school. So that helped tremendously with the company.
Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to stay in college and finish your degree as opposed to leaving to really get the company off the ground?
Well, the official answer is my mother. You do not want to get on her bad side. The unofficial answer is that, you know, I thought I could definitely learn a lot more. There was a lot of uncertainty on where the industry was going. You have to understand the antivirus industry is one of the most broken industries that exists. These traditional vendors that you may buy off of the shelves in, you know, Best Buy or Fry's Electronics simply don't do a service to you anymore. And trying to disrupt that industry, I mean, there was so much uncertainty. The other part was it was kind of the sunken cost fallacy. You know, I've already made it through 2.5, 3 years. There's just one more year left. And it actually turned out to be about 4.5 years that I stayed at the university.
Spoken like a true entrepreneur. And I wanted to ask you, so now you're 26, your company has, you've got more than 350 employees in 15 countries. You officially started the company in Chicago, right?
I did. I started the company in Chicago, moved down to University of Illinois, graduated, moved back to Chicago for 2 years, and then finally moved out here to California, to the Bay Area.
I was going to ask you about that. Why did you decide to move out to the Bay Area? I know that particularly in Illinois, there's a lot of emphasis on trying to grow a startup culture here. Did you just find that the Bay Area was just too irresistible?
I did not, and I actually think I would have been better off in Chicago and dream of the day I get to return back to Illinois. But the story goes that when I was at the University of Illinois, I had a partner out here in the Bay Area, And I hired him, and he started really the ground operations. So when I had graduated, we had about 125 people in San Francisco, and I simply couldn't relocate all of them, and me being remote just didn't make any more sense. So I regretfully, well, maybe not regretfully, but moved out to the Bay Area. It's starting to grow on me. The weather, especially during the winter in Chicago, can definitely be pretty good here.
Marston, I wonder if you can kind of, if we can kind of shift our conversation to talking about cyber threats and what you see as, this is your industry, obviously, with Malwarebytes. What do you think are the biggest threats facing us today? And I'm going to go really broad with this, so not just personally, but governments. Where do you see as the biggest problem right now?
This is a very cyclical problem. Every year there's some new threat. And if I look at just this year and today, ransomware has become a very very significant threat. And what ransomware is, it's a malware infection that you can get pretty much anywhere, opening a bad email, going to a bad website, even a legitimate website that may be hosting some bad content. And once it gets on your computer, it actually encrypts all of your documents so that you can't access them, and asks for a $500 to $1,000 ransom to get your files back. So imagine a college student that's working on his or her PhD thesis, and all of a sudden malware has taken over the computer without really them clicking on anything and asking for $500 to $1,000 to get the files back.
How often
now,
does that happen?
That scales to, very often. This is a $500 to a billion-dollar industry, $500 million to a billion-dollar industry for these criminals. And they're starting to really prey on big businesses where maybe cloud backups don't exist. And if you start, you know, encrypting files at a large enterprise and they don't have backups of it, you better believe they're willing to pay for those files back. So it's a very good money-making industry.
Well, and then we have to also worry about things like malvertising. What's that?
So malvertising is a delivery mechanism for malware like ransomware. You go to a very benign website, think of your favorite news website, and there's content, obviously, that is sponsored by advertising. And a lot of this content is provided by third-party advertisers. So you see all these ads, and maybe you click on them because there's something interesting, maybe you don't. The unfortunate part of that is these ads are served by many, many different companies worldwide. The news outlet, for example, may not even know what ads are being served. And because of the scale of these ads, it's actually pretty easy to upload a bad ad to these websites. And without even clicking on this bad ad, it can infect your computer. So this is, malvertising is becoming a very efficient way of delivering this kind of malware. And the end result is to get ransomware, which makes the criminal money. So now they can invest even more into this advertising business.
Marston, as you say all of this, I wonder how you think all of these things mean in terms of how we should be rethinking how we're approaching cybersecurity.
Yeah, it's a great question. At this point, I think privacy is one of the biggest concerns. And using your computer, it's obviously something you have to do very carefully. So I always recommend to never give your credentials, your social security number, any healthcare information, any tax identification information. Try not to keep that on your computer for too long. If you are submitting it somewhere, make sure you're submitting it to somewhere that's legitimate and has, you know, the stamp of approval. Let's say it's an IRS.
But don't even keep it on your computer, you think? Wow.
You know, I try to keep everything. Yeah.
So you have it backed up on, you have it on a drive that's not attached to your computer. That's where you keep your, that's what you think people should do.
That's certainly one way I keep my information, but I certainly don't keep it in my inbox because, you know, that's outsourced to a third party, and you can only trust a third party for so long. I think at this point, most Americans have had their credit card replaced, have had their social security number viewed somewhere. It's becoming a pretty tremendous problem worldwide.
Well, and I also wonder about security on phones. I was actually having a conversation with my mom the other day where I was telling her, don't PayPal on your phone if you're not on your home wireless network that's secured. I think so much of what we're doing right now is on our phones. That's like a whole other layer of this, right?
I think it's less the phone itself and more of what you just said, which is connecting to insecure Wi-Fi networks, whether it's at a Starbucks, whether it's at a hotel, and then transacting or doing something that, you know, has your personal information is certainly an exposure risk. There's a lot of ways that an attacker can get, it's called a man-in-the-middle attack, can get in the middle of that transaction and potentially steal the data. And as encryption, and this is a big debate on a government level today, as encryption gets more popular, those issues are actually mitigated, but also, you know, a lot of the information that some three-letter agencies are collecting today would be not exposed any longer. So that's where the debate actually is coming from.
We just have about less than a minute left, but I just wonder if you can give us a preview of your TEDx talk tomorrow.
Absolutely. So the TEDx conference tomorrow actually revolves around the word uncharted. And I rattled my brain for hours on what do I want to talk about at this talk. And then I realized that just being an entrepreneur in itself is uncharted. Every single day is uncharted. I really want to focus through a couple of stories on how to get through that on a daily basis and what that means to be an entrepreneur.
That's Marcin Kliczynski. He's the founder and CEO of Malwarebytes Corporation. Speaking at TEDx tomorrow, I should mention it's sold out. We'll tweet the link out to the site so you can check out his talk later when it's posted online. Thanks, Marcin.
Thank you.
Coming up, the choreographer from Kiss Me, Kate. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by the library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing students and scholars for their fields by offering access to today's cutting-edge equipment and technology within advanced library environments and facilities. The University Library at Illinois.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As we said, a fast-moving situation going on in Springfield this morning regarding funding of state universities. It does look like the Illinois Senate has now also passed the bill, $600 million for higher education. Governor Rauner is expected to sign that soon. So stay tuned. All this hour and throughout the day, we'll keep you updated on that situation. You're listening to The 21st.
In all the leading rackets, from which rip roaring rich I happen to be. And if thou wouldst attain the upper brackets, marry me, marry me, marry me.
That's Tom, Dick, or Harry from the original soundtrack of the musical Kiss Me, Kate. It opened at Krannert Center's Tryon Festival Theater in Urbana last night and will run through Sunday. Kiss Me, Kate was one of the first shows to feature interracial actors. It was also the first to win the Tony Award for Best Musical. The Cole Porter score allows for an eclectic mix of dance styles from jazz to waltz. That eclectic mix of music and dance is also a good way to describe the career of the choreographer for this production of Kiss Me, Kate, Endelin Taylor. Endelin is an assistant professor of dance at the University of Illinois. Prior to coming to the university, she had a long dance career that took her from ballet to Broadway and beyond, and she's here to tell us about that. Endelin, welcome to The 21st. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start with your career because you got your start in dance as a girl growing up in Chicago in the 1970s. When did you realize you wanted to be a ballerina?
Well, I realized early on that I was extremely creative and a little bit unusual in the things that interest me. From an early age, I was always dressing up and playing very much by myself, but kind of unusual things. I was a gymnast winning a gold medal. I was inviting people to my wedding who came to the front door. And so I was in
a sheet. At what age was this?
Oh, this was 7, 8 years old. So my
you were winning the Olympics, yes, getting married, yes, a very active imagination.
Very active imagination.
And did you go to a lot of dance performances as a child?
I didn't go to a lot of dance performances as a child, but my mom introduced me to dancers, and particularly dancers of color at an early age. One of the women that she always talked about was Josephine Baker, and that unusual kind of gift that she had of being extremely talented and humorous and making her assets the very thing that was most different about her. So I think my mom was really kind of the one who gave me the courage to go against the grain of things. And choosing ballet was certainly against the grain of growing up on the South Side of Chicago.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you. As an African-American young woman growing up on the South Side of Chicago in the 70s, did you see other ballet dancers that looked like you?
I did not see other ballet dancers that looked like me, not until a lot later in my training. And when I did, it was because my teacher and my mentor, his name is Larry Long, he was the director of a school called the Ruth Page School of Dance. He took me to see the Dance Theater of Harlem when they came to the Auditorium Theater. They used to come on a regular basis. And prior to that, I was always training kind of within a bubble of looking very different aesthetically, not just the color of my skin, but my sinew and my muscularity and my athleticism was not something that I got to see a lot of in a ballet class, in pink tights and in pointe shoes. But it just resonated with me from such an early age.
Well, and that's an interesting thing you bring up of the style of dance, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think that we don't often see very many African-American ballet dancers. But as you said, the style, I mean, I think in our head, we all think of whether they're male or female, very tall, very skinny, very lithe sort of ballet dancers. And then if you think of, you know, sort of more of modern dance or even like an Alvin Ailey, that's so much more physical. Mm-hmm. I wonder how much diversity you think there is in, first of all, in ballet for other body types and that and what you're talking about. Has that changed?
It's certainly changing. And I think one of the most interesting things about the perception of ballet is the misnomer that it is not physical. It's incredibly physical.
But the whole point is that you think you're making it look like it's not physical.
That's right.
You're not supposed to be sweating. Right?
You're not even supposed to be of this earth most of the time, especially with early ballets, the classics. You were something ethereal. You were a sylph or a fairy or anything that was above and beyond what the norm and natural is. And so I think just that in and of itself is a challenge when you associate that with dancers of color and particularly women of color, because the things that I feel I would stereotypically say about an African-American woman is strength and determination, perseverance, holding down the fort in the family, you know, meeting those everyday practical things in life, as opposed to this idea of extremely feminine, the epitome of lightness and fairydom, you know, pixie
dust.
Well,
and certainly I would think any professional dancer needs to have a lot of strength and determination. And
absolutely.
I wonder how much of your formation came from being 16 years old, launching your professional ballet career, joining the Dance Theater of Harlem, which is considered to be the first Black classical ballet company. Do you think that maybe at 16 was part of your formation of going into first the ballet world?
I definitely do. As I said, I saw them when I was 15 years old, and it was like the heavens opened up, because it was the first time that I saw women and men on stage who looked like me and who had makeup on that I could identify with, and who wore brown tights and brown pointe shoes as opposed to pink tights and pink pointe shoes. So I think that had such a powerful impact on me, and really an affirmation that I'm not alone, and that this is something that is completely possible.
It's just such an interesting thing to even think about makeup and tights and things like that. Was that an issue originally when in the 80s? Was it hard to find things like that?
Yes, they didn't really exist back then. I can't recall being able to go into a store and just buy tights that matched the color of my skin. And at Dance Theater of Harlem, we had costume designers and wardrobe department. They customized our tights for us. And it was a very lengthy process to make each one of us have the tights that not just were the color of our outward skin tone, but the undertones, because underneath the lights, if you have a yellow skin tone and your tights are reddish, it won't exactly match, because the lights on stage highlight everything.
And then I wonder what it was like, your transition from being a principal ballerina, because eventually you got to that point of the Dance Theater of Harlem, to performing in musicals on Broadway. Why did you decide to make that transition?
I really decided to make that transition because by that point I was married and I had a son who went on tour with us. He was the company baby. He took his first steps on stage. He had more press than we did when we toured South Africa. He's the one in the arms of Nelson Mandela.
Did you dance? But you didn't dance. How did you manage that, being pregnant and having a child? You must have taken some time off.
I danced until my seventh month.
Wow.
And I came back after 4 months and went right back on tour. And he truly was the company baby. Whoever wasn't on stage was holding him. And then when that person came off stage or it was time for them to go on, then they just passed him on. So he really did develop this sense of the arts at a very early age. I really wonder if he thought that anybody could just do a pirouette out of nowhere, because that was kind of his community and environment.
So it looks like, so it sounds like Broadway musicals made it a little bit easier for you to have a family life.
It did. It did.
Which I imagine that's kind of an interesting, because most people might not think that's the case. But how was that?
Because with a ballet company like Dance Theater of Harlem, we toured. We toured 9 months out of the year. And I literally one day decided, I wonder if I could do a Broadway show. Because that stays, that sits. And if you're lucky, it's a successful one and it will have a run that will keep you still doing what you love to do, dancing, but in one place. And then he could start to form his, you know, social life, going to school and all of those things. And so I tried out for Carousel, which was my first show, because I knew it had a strong ballet base. I didn't have any formal acting or singing training, but I grew up in church and I knew I could carry a tune. And I sang a church song. I sang Amazing Grace and I got the job.
And what were you cast? Who were you cast as?
I was cast as a core dancer. I had some featured roles and I understudied Mrs. Mullins, who's the older woman who was kind
of
in love,
who runs
the house and the carnival.
Yeah. Okay. I wonder, when you're thinking, and I'm thinking particularly of Carousel, when you're thinking about being an African-American woman, what year was this that you did Carousel?
Oh, gosh.
This was also back in, this was like in the mid-80s?
It was the early
90s. Was there a lot of diversity among casting? Because I know that tends to be sometimes a controversial issue in the theater in terms of who's cast for what roles.
There wasn't a lot on Broadway, but this show was one of the ones that was really touted for its diversity. There were 9 African-Americans in that production.
And it's a big cast, obviously.
A huge cast, but there were other ethnicities as well. Usually one of the things you find when you're going on auditions is that you quickly learn that you're competing against the 2 or 3 other people of color in the room, not necessarily African-American. It may be Hispanic. It may be Asian. But you know that there's 1 or 2 slots for you, and usually
for
one.
For everybody.
For everybody. One male and one female in terms of that
people
ethnic
of color.
Role.
Okay.
Yes.
And do you think there still are those quote unquote ethnic roles? Because I know certainly there's been discussion about that in Hollywood, but do you think particularly in theater there's still that as well?
I think there is. I think there is. I just saw a beautiful show in New York, American in Paris. And there was one African-American female in the cast. And I think shows that are made for dancers of color are becoming more prevalent, which is wonderful and great. But I still think that there aren't a lot of spaces and consideration for the diversity of a production that may not have anything to do with an ethnic content.
Well, and I also think it's really interesting when you think about plays like Carousel, you think of other Rodgers and Hammerstein productions that have nowadays are criticized for, Carousel, the domestic violence, I'm thinking of... not necessarily Rodgers and Hammerstein, but Gilbert and Sullivan, and sort of lots of other criticisms for the racism that at the time was just sort of normal. But now when you stage these sort of modern productions, how do you handle that? And I was going to ask you in particular, because there's a scene in Kiss Me, Kate, I want to talk about with you in a second. But as you're doing modern adaptations, you know, Carousel has that. When I was looking, I was at the Lyric Productions last year, and I found that it's sort of a little off-putting when, you know, there's just when he just hits her, and I was like, we're not talking about this at all. It's kind of a weird thing.
It is, very much so. And I should say that one of the things that I've always been involved and engaged in are social justice issues and domestic violence in particular. I've done a lot of work with an organization called the Institute Against Domestic Violence within the African American community. So when I was asked to do Kiss Me, Kate, and knowing that this scene was in there, it was really one of the first things that I wanted to discuss with the rest of the production staff. And the fact that we're predominantly female, the main production staff. And so we did meet, we did talk about it, and we thought immediately, okay, we can't discard it because it is ingrained in the script. And that would be a disservice to the script. But we can put a spin on it as best we can so that we modernize it and update it in some way. It's a very challenging thing to do.
And so, Endelin, the scene that we're talking about in the choreography for Kiss Me, Kate, I had a chance to see the production last night, and there's the scene where Fred as Petruchio spanks Lily as Catherine. And yes. I think, though, the way that you all handled this with the production was great, because you kind of do this social media reaction
right
after the moment where he hits her, and then you have sort of all of the tweets of people horrified. And I think my favorite was, is this the new Chris Brown? Which was such a great, I thought, domestic violence, a way to sort of modernize the domestic violence conversation. Is that, I mean, who came up with that idea for how to do that adaptation of how to deal with everything?
Well, Sarah Johnson, who was the director, and I, we talked. It was one of the first things that we were thinking, okay, how are we getting around this? So I think in the conversation, it kind of evolved out of that. And we knew we wanted to modernize it anyway. And that particular scene seemed to be most in need of something that could not lighten it, but modernize it and take a bit of the sting out of it.
How did you modernize the dance as well?
Well, the dance is kind of timeless in the sense of the music. Cole Porter did a wonderful thing for choreographers in that he made it so very diverse, where he included so many different styles of music and tempos and rhythms that I was able to play with. Little bit of contemporary, obviously the ballet, there's jazz, there's a tiny bit of burlesque. So that was really in the music. So any choreographer would relish working with that type of material that doesn't put you in a box.
That type of material is in Kiss Me, Kate. It runs through Sunday at Krannert Center's Tyron Festival Theater in Urbana. Endelin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I
wanted to.
It.
Yeah, thank you. Let's go out listening to the title track of Kiss Me, Kate.
So kiss me, Kate, and twice and thrice, ere we start living in paradise. So kiss me, Kate, darling angel divine.
Coming up on the 21st, the Midwest origins of one of America's most beloved cookbooks, and we'll keep you updated on what's going on in Springfield with the House and Senate. You're listening to the 21st.
No one shall ever be born. Oh, no.
The 21st is made possible by Custer & Bradley, LLP, providing legal service to the Urbana-Champaign community since 1895. Custer & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at CusterLawLLP.com.
This is the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Tonight at sundown, Passover begins. The food at many Seder tables will likely include staples like brisket and matzo ball soup. And some of the most beloved household recipes may come from one of America's best-selling cookbooks. First published in 1901, the Settlement House Cookbook sold more than 2 million copies through its more than 40 editions. By way of comparison, Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking has sold about 1.5 million copies, and it's still in print. Joining us now to share the not-often-known Midwestern and Jewish roots of that cookbook is Ellie Gettinger. She's the Education Director of the Jewish Museum, Milwaukee. Ellie, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. I'm glad to be here.
Can you tell us about the Settlement House and who was Lizzie Kander who started the Settlement House before she even wrote this cookbook?
So the Settlement House in Milwaukee was the social norm. It was a way of Americanizing the new poor immigrants who were coming to Milwaukee, who were primarily, especially the Jewish ones, Russian and Eastern European. Lizzie Kander, her parents had come about 50 years earlier and established themselves. They were from Germany, and there was this divide in Milwaukee and Jewish communities all over the country where the German Jewish community wanted to figure out, how are we going to take care of these new people and make sure they don't embarrass us, that, you know, that this doesn't lead to increased anti-Semitism, that their ways, which seemed more superstitious or impractical, would reflect badly on the established German Jewish community. And so the Settlement House was a way of dealing with that.
So when you say that, I wonder if you can give us a sense of what the Jewish community was like in Milwaukee. And I imagine this was happening in large cities across the country, particularly in the Midwest and along the East Coast. You're saying there were older German Jews like Lizzie Kander. Was there even their faith practice different than these newer arrivals? And I guess this was like in the late 1800s, right?
Right. So the Germans were primarily in the high German Reform tradition, which meant that they would, and there had been all sorts of adaptations within this, that they might even go to a service where there's an organ and the service would be conducted in German potentially or English, whereas the newer immigrants were more orthodox in their practice. And so there was, you know, not just a language gap. They could communicate probably in German and at some point in English, but then there also was this cultural gap that these people, while they shared the same religious background, that it was a very different way of observing this. And so for Lizzie and her compatriots, they really were struggling with this sense of, you know, there's a much larger new group of Jews who are coming into the community. How do we make sure that this doesn't reflect badly upon us?
So how did she do that? What kind of things did she teach them in order to, as you say, not reflect badly on the broader Jewish community?
All sorts of things. The Settlement House, I think of it now as like a wholesale kind of stop for every age in the continuum. They had everything from childcare, which was very helpful because one of the big challenges, and the way she started getting involved in this activity was she was a truant officer. So she saw how many kids weren't going to school because they were watching their other kids or doing things around the house. So that was one piece.
Okay.
They had language classes for adults and civics lessons and things like that, how to be an American, those sorts of things. And then for kids, anything from sports to drama societies to cooking classes. And the cooking class was really this vehicle to say, we are going to get you to be Americanized through the art of cooking like us, upper-class German Jewish
people. And so what kind of foods did she teach them to make? What kind of quote-unquote American foods were they learning?
They were learning, you know, they learned things like Kuchen and Bundkuchen, but then things that were kind of maybe more traditionally German. And then they would start with very simple, this is how you measure. Because I think at the turn of the 20th century, most of the way cooking was taught was an oral tradition where it would be a scoop of this, a pinch of that. And so Lizzie was all about teaching them scientific methods and saying, this is, you know, you're using teaspoons and cup measures, you're doing this and this technique, you're washing your hands, you know, those sorts of things that were more hygienic and stuff like that. That was really a big aim of her cooking classes as well.
And why did she decide to put all of this into a cookbook? Why did she do the cookbook?
There were two major things that were going on. One, she's thinking, I want to figure out how to make a sustaining fundraiser so I don't have to keep going back to the same people in my community. But there was a little bit of a stigma against a woman asking for money and developing some sort of business model that then becomes a self-sustaining fundraiser. So that was on one hand. So she decides, you know what, a cookbook might be a really good thing to do. And she fronts it instead of being this fundraiser aspect, this is going to be a textbook for my students. So I'm going to create this textbook. It'll have their the recipes that we're using in class, additional recipes, and it's going to be a great way of supporting the Settlement House because it's the secondary usage, that it was a way of doing this. So she goes to her board of directors, all gentlemen that she's recruited to be part of the Settlement House, and says, I need $18 to create this cookbook. And they say they don't really see the point.
They said no.
No. You know, they probably have cooks. Their wives probably don't even cook at this point. Like, these are pretty, you know, upper-class men at this time. So the idea of a cookbook just seems totally, like, who would buy it?
Well, there weren't really cookbooks. I mean, the cookbooks weren't really a thing, right?
Right, totally. So she goes, a friend of hers, husband, is a publisher, and they figure out a whole system where they sell ads for it. One of my favorite ads, there's a hotel in Milwaukee. It still exists. One of the nicest hotels in Milwaukee. It's called the Pfister. And the ad for the Pfister says, the first fireproof hotel in Milwaukee, which is saying something about the time. You're like,
right.
Great advertising. It's terrifying.
You're not going to die in your sleep with the hotel burning down.
Here.
And so that's how she published it. Now, how did this cookbook become so popular throughout all of America? How did it spread from Milwaukee to becoming this American staple?
So it starts in they do a run, I think, of about 500, and they sell it for 50 cents a piece, they do a run of 1,000, it makes $500, which if you think about your investment of $18 turning over into $500.
In 1901, that's pretty great.
Yeah, it's $13,000 in today's terms. So she has this whole series of things that she's doing, and they start, there's this Milwaukee-Chicago hub. For those of you who don't know, Milwaukee and Chicago are quite close to each other. We're about an hour and a half away, 90 miles. And so as people in Milwaukee have family members and start giving it to people in Chicago, they start saying, well, this is a great book. And then other people are in Chicago and start seeing this. And so it comes in, you know, it's kind of this viral marketing that starts very early where you have, you know, just word of mouth. And then it becomes, they actually see that there's a national market and they start marketing it that way.
What's in your, so do you see this cookbook as maybe, I wonder what you think the true story of this cookbook is. Is it really more of, I mean, because we have been talking about it being a Jewish story, a Midwestern story. I mean, it sounds like it's really an American story.
I think it really is. I think it's something that speaks to the ongoing struggle with how we deal with our new immigrants. That's certainly one of the things in looking at the Passover story that comes to play. You know, how do we deal with the people who are different than us in a community? And while I won't say that this is like the most sensitive way of dealing with people, this is the sort of thing where she's saying, we need to figure out what we can do, how we can make their lives better, because this is going to improve our lives as well. So I think there's that side of the story. And one thing that happens as the cookbook evolves, you know, it's 40 different editions, that she's constantly taking in new cuisines and new techniques and new technologies for whatever the housekeeper needs to make their lives easy in what they're doing. And so I think that she sees this as the sort of thing, it's certainly part of an American dream. There are lots of things within this that are aspirational. If you look at the diagram in some of the, not in the very first editions, but in by the fourth or fifth, there's a diagram that shows you how to set a table. And it includes, and this is for a simple table, by the way, and it includes like three forks and two spoons and double sets of beverage, you know, and the people who she's teaching, they would not have had five forks between the family, and yet this is saying, this is what you should be attaining. So there's this sense of how do you get to this other realm of culture, of not maybe culture, but of an American dream. How do you be part of that? And mm-hmm. You wanted to make that accessible in some way.
So Ellie, you're actually speaking to us from your family's home in Tennessee. I appreciate you taking the time before, I'm sure, what is a busy Passover evening for you guys tonight. Are you all planning any Settlement House recipes for your Seder this evening?
We are not, but we definitely have some like traditional, we're doing a pretty traditional meal. I just finished making a potato kugel. And the recipe I used is actually from Susie Fishbein's Kosher by Design book. It's foolproof.
if anybody's looking for it.
Okay. Well, because, and we should add, because the Settlement House cookbook is out of print. So those are kind of hard to find these days.
They are. And I will say, my parents grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Atlanta, Georgia, and both of them grew up with the Settlement cookbook, which really does speak to how national this story became.
There's a permanent exhibit about the Settlement House cookbook at the Jewish Museum, Milwaukee, where Ellie Gettinger is education director. Thanks for being with us, Ellie.
It's my pleasure. And for those of you celebrating tonight, have a great Passover.
Yes, I was going to say the same to you. Happy Passover to you and your family, Ellie. Passover begins at sundown this evening. It's so late this year, by the way, because it's a leap year for the Jewish calendar. So happy Passover, Ellie, to you.
We get a whole other month.
I was gonna
say. Don't just do days, we do months. We, nothing in half measures.
Thanks, Ellie. Enjoy your Passover.
You too. Bye-bye.
We talked earlier this hour about legislation in Springfield that would fund state colleges and universities through the summer. Those schools have gone without state funding for almost a year. The bill passed the House last hour with bipartisan support. Just a few minutes ago, the state Senate also overwhelmingly approved the bill. Next, it heads to the governor's desk. Bruce Rauner put out a statement after the Senate vote indicating he'll sign it. The governor also expressed hope that legislators will, quote, build on this bipartisan success in future budget negotiations. Assuming Governor Rauner signs that, the proposal would bring almost some $600 million to state higher education system that, of course, has seen no state money for almost a year. The money would help stabilize many schools, but it does represent a significant cut from what Democrats proposed last year. Legislators have said they're hoping to address funding for social services next. There's a lot going on with this story. We'll have more on that and what it means for Illinois campuses throughout the day and on Monday's show. And a reminder, of course, this bill comes at a critical time for Chicago State University, which is on the verge of closing its doors. Democrat State Representative Jack Franks, who voted no on the bill, says he prefers a full resolution to the budget that should have taken effect July 1st. If you're curious, money for the bill is possible because of a surplus in the state's education assistance fund. The funding proposal also has nearly $170 million in tuition grants for low-income students. So news on state funding and MAP grants, we'll have more on this throughout the day. For us today, that does it for us today on the 21st. We're produced by Amanda Huntingfort, Christine Herman, and Austin Keating. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft, with help today from Jerry Moorfield. Scott Cameron is our news director. Special thanks to the Midwest Band Public Access for the music we've been playing on the 21st. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As we say goodbye today, speaking of music, our 21st show tribute to Prince, who passed away yesterday. We wanted to play for you. We asked on social media what song we should play to close out today's program. Thank you for all of your suggestions, many that we cannot play on public radio or, frankly, any radio airwaves. So we went with one of our staff favorites, Kiss. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. You could